If we've yet to meet, my name is Josh, and like Bethany was saying accurately, after years at Bridgetown, some of them as a pastor, myself, my wife, a team of folks, planted a like-minded church in downtown Vancouver called Van City. So often I'll run into, you know, one or two of you in a grocery store or something like that, and people ask, how is Vancouver? It's quite a broad question. Unfortunately, my perspective of Vancouver is decidedly narrow. I'm not the mayor. I don't have a deep familiarity with everything going on, so forgive me if the question rattles me from time to time, just so you know. Now, like you guys, we have been working our way just the same through the practices of Jesus, learning what it means to be with Jesus, to become like Jesus, and to do the things that Jesus did. So John Mark asked if I'd come and hang out with you guys and talk about something called imaginative prayer. And I said, if the price is right. And he said, we have air conditioning. And I said, my church doesn't, so I'll be there. Now, they're presumably all sweaty right now. Imaginative prayer really is a discipline that has been massively formational in not only my approach to prayer, but in the way that I understand God and consequently how I relate to Him. So we will spend the next small stretch talking about how much your brain weighs, your memories of spiders, and the way that you spend your time with Jesus. Are you guys ready? Great, thank you. Though I have taught at Bridgetown many times, I realize it's been quite a spell, and I'm often told that due largely to the dry manner in which I joke, my audience sometimes struggles to understand when I intend to be funny. So I don't want to inhibit our time together. I will suggest two specific tools for navigating tonight's humor. One, a long stare ordinarily indicates a punchline. And two, when in doubt, just try laughing. I will correct you if it is done so inappropriately. That was inappropriate. Bad start. Now, I want to begin by inviting each of you into a bit of an experiment in memory. The first step is a really easy one. I'm going to pose a simple question, and I want you to answer it mentally. That is, not out loud, mentally. What is in the backseat of your car at the moment? If you don't have a car, imagine the last car in which you took a ride. You got it? Now, I want you to consider an interesting secondary question. How did you just do that? That is, how did you do the mental exercise of retrieving the answer to the question, what's in the backseat of your car? Now, sure, there's some technical explanation about the sophisticated functionality of the brain, but our interest is in what you experienced when you accomplished that thought experiment. Thanks to neuroscience, we know that some of you instantaneously experienced an image in your mind of your backseat. Some of you saw the backseat as if from the vantage of someone seated in the front seat, turning around to look behind them. Others saw the backseat as though they were outside the car, looking in through the window. For some of you, the experience was a still picture that flashed for a moment before it faded. Others of you saw the backseat as if it were captured on video. Some of you probably even interacted with the contents of your backseat mentally. You moved certain things around to remember what was under a coat or a package. A small portion of you, statistically, may have even smelled your car during the experiment, which could be good or bad, depending. The point is, none of you experienced anything like a blank screen in your mind that displayed conceptual strings of information. You didn't read a teleprompter in your mind that said your backseat contains A, B, and C, and then use that to answer the question, because your brain doesn't work that way. Instead, you experienced your car's backseat. Your brain replicated and represented, or re-presented more literally, reality. And it was, in some sense, all in your head. Now, the contents of your car, it stands to reason, are not terribly emotional, at least for most of us. And even so, every one of you understands that your brain does have the power to access an emotional storehouse of memory and experience. So let's do that next. Take a moment right now and bring to mind an event from the past that you find particularly pleasant. Maybe like vacation, or for me, it's always something to do with Christmas, some meaningful moment with a loved one or a noteworthy achievement, some specific happy memory. Go ahead and think of it now and then hold on to it for a moment. Some of you, right now, are seeing pictures or something like a video in your mind. Some of you hear sounds or even smell odors. A few of you may even be representing something that you tasted imaginatively. Some of you might feel a very vague memory of happiness, and others of you are lucky enough to have a brain that's releasing chemicals right now that allows you to re-experience that happiness just by accessing the memory itself. For others, it's somehow both good and bad. It's a sort of bittersweet. Some of you know why that is, and others of you have no clue. No two people represent a pleasant memory exactly the same. To illustrate, let's pose a few additional questions for your consideration. Did you personally experience the memory as visual only, without sound, or could you hear it in your mind? Was it a still frame, or was it a series of moving pictures, or was it one after the other? Did it alternate? Did the visuals fade, or were you able to hold on to them? Was the memory in color? Because now we know statistically many of you experience your memories in black and white. Statistically, about half of you are associated to your memory, so you experience it as if looking through your own eyes. The other half are disassociated and thus see themselves in the memory as they behold it from a third-person perspective. And of course, our memories are never perfect recreations of any given event. Your brain makes certain decisions about what's important in reconstructing a moment or an event, focusing in on certain details while ignoring others altogether. And we rarely get any conscious say in the process. My wife's brain, for example, seems to operate on some recurring equation that multiplies the actual size of any given spider, seen from a distance, up closer in a photograph, and the more the story is told, the bigger the spider gets. It's like some kind of exponential increase. I have my own struggles with accuracy, frankly. A few months ago, Gerald, and who's the guy that kept saying, Gerald? It sounded like you're right here. Gerald, you'll love this story about Gerald. a few months ago, Gerald and I were skateboarding together, as we often do, and we were in the skate park. They had two levels, so I was on the top level, Gerald's on the bottom level, and I heard a crash, which is not altogether unusual. So I finished what I was doing, you know, and then I peered over the rail to the lower level of the skate park, and I found Gerald examining his shin. Distraught he was. He kept saying, "Shoot, man," like that, "Shoot, man," and like some southerner all of a sudden, "Shoot, man." I was like, well, that's strange. I've never heard him say either of those words together. So, rushing to his aid, I found his shin splayed open, this horrible yawning wound and a geyser of blood. It was awful. Disgusting. There were only moments to save his life. And I did my best to bandage the wound in order to buy us enough time for the ambulance to arrive. Really did. I bandaged it up. It was gross. I'm grateful every day that he didn't lose the leg. When I see him walking around, pray a little prayer of gratitude, you know. Now, if you were there, maybe you'd say that it was more like a small cut. That is, after all, what the photographs seemed to suggest when I showed them to my friends afterward. You know, maybe an inch or two long, and it bled, for sure, but it was easily remedied with a few stitches by the time Gerald found his way to the doctor after he went and picked up his kids from school. But he did really say, shoot, man, at least I think he did. Maybe I'm making that part up, too. If you were there, you may have underemphasized the event when unpacking the memory, and we don't always do this with any ulterior motive whatsoever, other than our brains have a unique and strange sense of recalling things. All of this fantastic nuance and incredible imaginative capability because your brain is freaking bonkers. Though it weighs only 3.5 pounds, it looks like a slimy tangle of bubble gum. You know, a single gram of your brain's matter is more sophisticated than we can begin to fathom with our brains. I keep picking the same guy to stare at. Yeah, you know what I'm talking about, Mr. Glasses. All right, let's have one more experiment before we move on. I want you to think of a person, this is serious, I want you to think of a person that you love very much. Now, None of you accomplish this by reciting information about this person in your mind. Instead, you all imaginatively represented them in your mind, visually. You can even provoke your emotions with this mental representation by imagining this person doing something kind or loving toward you. Go ahead, try it. It's quite nice. Or adversely, you can provoke your emotions by imagining them being cruel or unkind to you. You don't have to do that. Now, if I imagine my wife, Abby, I don't begin by reading sentences from the screen of my mind. Someone says, think of a loved one, and then I see a teleprompter that says, Abby has red hair, she was born in Portland, she likes toast, you know, whatever, this gets data about Abby. These pieces of data can absolutely contribute to my affection for Abby, but our relationship has not been shaped by data alone. It is a complicated amalgamation built from years of experiences, both good and bad, simple and profound. Abstracted information or data alone falls short in relational connectedness. Now consider for a moment that each of our three lifelong goals as disciples of Jesus, to be with Jesus, to become like Jesus, to do what Jesus did, are all unique aspects of a relational dynamic. That is, we can accomplish none of these things apart from an active and dynamic relationship with the master to whom we apprentice. And yet, so many of us approach our spiritual formation, which is the process by which we are made more like Jesus, by way of information, you know, books and sermons primarily. The conceit being that information can, in and of itself, lead to transformation. We think, you know, with the right church, the right book, the right Bible study, we will get to some sort of consistent measure of significant change. And yet, interestingly, disciples of Jesus have more access to information than ever before, and yet so many of us feel as though we are no closer to being transformed than when we first took up with Jesus. And there are certainly a variety of reasons for that, but tonight I will argue that one fundamental reason is that we do not use our imaginations as disciples of Jesus. In fact, for many, the word imagination itself is little more than a synonym for make-believe or for fantasy. And I know what you're thinking. Didn't the Temptations clearly sing, it was just my imagination running away with me? They did. But it's like I say all too often, we cannot base our lives on Temptation lyrics. Thank you. Every time I've done it, it's rarely funny to any of you guys, but it's really funny to me. Now, as per the design of the human brain, you and I do not think in lines of information. We've argued that already. We do not see a teleprompter in our mind from which we read lines of text. Instead, we think by imaginatively recreating reality in our minds. Imagination is simply the mind's ability to evoke images of things that are not physically present. This is why, when asked to think of a loved one, your mind immediately offered mental images based on memories of seeing them, being in their presence, hearing their voice. And these memories are themselves injected with powerful formational emotions. So herein lies the question: how can we access powerful, formative representations of a relationship for which there are no physical memories? How can we be formed in a relationship that, in the strict sense, features no physical touch, no audible voice, no visual presence? I would argue that it can be done, but that our minds play the instrumental role in the process. So, turn in the New Testament, if you will, six books into a letter called Romans, Romans chapter 12. Romans, as many of you, I'm sure, are well aware, was drafted by an expert-level apprentice of Jesus called Paul. And in it, he has a good bit to say about how we are formed, transformed, to be like Jesus. This seems like an excessive amount of frosting, you know? The bite, like you couldn't, I don't know, maybe you could, if you're ambitious, get a bite out of both at the same time. Who wants to bite into just the frosting? This is gross, isn't it? You don't want to do that. No. Disgust. So ungrateful. They give me this cupcake. I'm over here critiquing it publicly. Now, Romans chapter 12. Bethany, if you can hear me wherever you are, I really love the cupcake. Thank you. Romans chapter 12, verse 2, Paul writes this: do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then, after your mind is renewed, you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good, pleasing, and perfect will. Interesting. In order to be transformed, our minds themselves will need to experience a certain sense of renewal. When this happens, Paul says, we'll know God better. We'll know what he's like, and we'll know what he wants. Paul brings up this process of the mind several times. Turn just a few books over to the letter called Philippians. Let's look at Philippians chapter 4. I appreciate the level of analog books I'm hearing in the audience. Not to make you feel bad for your digital book. It's fine. It works. The text is there just the same. Maybe there's some kind of... Never mind. I'm not going to go any further with that. Philippians 4, read verse 8 with me. Finally, brothers and sisters, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about such things. One more time, turn to the very next book. This is the last one, a letter called Colossians. And let's look at just a small bit from chapter 3. Colossians chapter 3. Verse 1 says this, since then you have been raised with Christ, set your hearts on things above, where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on things above, not on earthly things. The point that I'm hoping to make is that the authors of the New Testament understood that the process by which we are transformed to become like Jesus has a good deal to do with the mind. Of course, many of us take for granted that Paul's preoccupation with our thoughts and our minds has to do with information only. That is, Paul's talking about more books, more theology, more Bible study, and certainly all of the above factor largely in our transformation, yes. But as I argued moments ago, data alone does not transform us because of the way God has designed our minds. Of course, the authors of the Bible have a very unique understanding of the way human beings interact with and relate to God, because throughout the Old Testament and on into the early church, the Bible is filled with instances in which God speaks to his people, he appears to them in visions, even dreams, and we don't know the details of every interaction with exact specificity, but what we do know is that the sort of relationship God shared with his people entailed experiential interaction. Abraham and his family spoke with God. So did Moses, along with a slew of Old Testament characters. After Jesus is executed and comes back from the dead, God gives the Holy Spirit to every follower of Jesus, making dreams and visions the widespread mode of God's communication. This is in Acts, quoting from Joel chapter 2. In the last days, God says, I will pour out my Spirit on all people. Your sons and daughters will prophesy. Your young men will see visions. Your old men will dream dreams. Even on my servants, both men and women, I will pour out my Spirit in those days, and they will prophesy. Both Peter and Paul, for example, prominent apostles of Jesus, experienced visions of Jesus. They spoke with him while praying. The first Christian martyr, if you know the story, Stephen, experienced a vision of Jesus just before he died. John was on an island experiencing one heck of a vision of Jesus that became the book we call Revelation. For one reason or another, many modern readers like you and I make the strange assumption that the Bible's many scenes of dialogue with God, of dreams, of visions, of God speaking to his people, all took place as concrete and objective experiences, meaning we tend to think that if we were there with a camera rolling, we could document the experience and the video would look much as the Bible describes it. And sometimes maybe that's the case, I don't know, but more often than not, there's nothing at all to indicate that the seeing and hearing with which the great figures of the Bible experienced God was of the physical variety at all. The reason is that God's ordinary mode of communicating in the Hebrew Scriptures, the New Testament, and today is to speak and to appear to the mind. When you exercise listening prayer, for example, most of us do not expect a physical manifestation of Jesus, nor an audible voice from God, and many of us hear and see him just the same. In this sense, The way that we hear and see God is a spiritual sort of hearing and seeing, and it is a personal rather than an objective experience in the sense that it's carried out between only the parties with whom God intends to communicate. It won't pick up on film, in other words. It's personal that way. Or to put it another way, the communication between God and his people takes place in what we would often describe as the imagination. And here, this word has nothing to do with fantasy or make-believe, but rather the mind's unique ability to evoke powerful formational images of things that are not physically present. In this sense, the imagination is not something that takes us away from the truth, but rather it has the ability to enable a powerful experience of the truth. Your imagination can represent images of things not physically present in order to answer the question, what's in the backseat of your car? It can re-energize emotional experiences from the past, for better or for worse. It can even shape your relationship with a loved one, all by simply representing something in your mind with images that is not physically there. In fact, I would argue that our detachment from the imagination in matters of discipleship often acts as an enormous barrier keeping us from the sort of connectedness and intimacy with God that comes easily with physically present loved ones. For so many, it comes as a tremendous challenge with God our Father, who is not physically present nor audible. Our lack of imagination keeps us stagnated in destructive patterns of habit, of fear, of detachment. When we allow old memories and experiences to play on in the theater of our mind rather than replacing them with powerful experiences of God. Something we've argued at both Van City and at Bridgetown throughout this series is that prayer, in the broad and truest sense, is really life with God. Meaning it's not just a privatized practice isolated to our special corners of reverence, but the ongoing, maintained awareness that all of our life is shared with God. So what does it mean to utilize the full potential of the imagination in prayer as life with God? Fascinatingly, church history is well stocked with this broad spectrum of influential figures who not only communicated with God through the imagination themselves, they advocated that all disciples of Jesus should do likewise. Because the visibility of Jesus, according to the New Testament, is quite important. John writes in his gospel, "Anyone who has seen me," these are Jesus' words, "has seen the Father. And the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth." Later, Paul points out that the Son is the image of the invisible God. Note that contrast. It seems important. The author of Hebrews says it this way, "Let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith." Now, of course, there is some level of figurative speaking here, as you and I can no more fix our literal eyes on a physically present Jesus than we can Abraham Lincoln or Freddie Mercury or whoever. And that's just the point. What are we then to do? As early as the first generation after the disciples, on through the early church, the Middle Ages, the Renaissance, the modern era, a tremendous amount of pastors and writers and theologians have answered that question by arguing that we see Jesus by representing him mentally in our imagination. Church Father Origen wrote, "Let us therefore always fix our gaze on this image, this imaginative image of God, so that we might be able to be reformed in its likeness." Orthodox theologian Callisto Swear argued that to dismiss the use of mental or physical images in prayer and worship is to imply that Christ's body and so his humanity is somehow unreal. 19th century revivalist Charles Finney described this vivid encounter that he shared with Jesus that transpired entirely in his imagination, writing this, "It seemed as if I met the Lord Jesus Christ face to face. It did not occur to me then, nor did it for some time afterward, that it was wholly a mental state. On the contrary, it seemed to me that I saw him as I would see any other man. I have always since regarded this as a most remarkable state of mind. For it seemed to me a reality that he stood before me, and I fell down at his feet and poured out my soul to him. I wept aloud like a child and made such confession as I could with my choked utterance." Finney did not meet with Jesus physically, by his own admission, but he did meet with Jesus. Finney's imagination represented that aspect of reality with vivid images. St. Francis argued for the same experience for all disciples of Jesus, saying, by means of the imagination, we confine our mind within the mystery in which we meditate, that it may not ramble to and fro, just as we shut up a bird in a cage or tie a hawk by his leash so that they may rest on the hand. You guys know how you tie up a hawk so that it can rest on your hand? It's a deeply familiar experience for most of us, and therefore relatable in that way. The point is, the scriptures, neuroscience, church history, our own experience, all seem to agree that the mind operates primarily in images, and that our relationships are often the product of those images or lack thereof. So if the imagination is indeed vital to prayer, which is life with God, how do we use it effectively? Are you guys still with me for a few more minutes? Doing good? Great, thank you. Now, I realize thus far it stands to reason that you're receiving this information in a variety of ways. Some of you, I suspect, already use your imagination in matters of spirituality by default. Way to go. Others, frankly, feel that all this talk about imagination and visuals of the mind is sounding dangerously weird, and you're worried that I'm about to ask you to light incense and stare into a lava lamp or something. Others weren't thinking that, but now you are. Others of you came in late and you're like, who is this? Me, get it? Before we end tonight, I want to set you guys up for this week's practice while simultaneously opening the door for an entirely new way of experiencing all of prayer, and at the risk of sounding a tad grandiose, your entire relationship with Jesus as well. And it is through the practice of imaginative prayer. Now, despite the fact that our brains process relational data, memories, formational experiences primarily through images, many of us pray without images. Despite the fact that our brains rarely operate in lines of abstract information, reading a monologue of data, that's exactly how many of us pray, as if we are reciting lines of data, like reading a letter or something. We just sort of talk out loud or in our minds, working to clear our minds of images rather than utilizing them. And then it should come as absolutely no surprise that our minds run desperately toward images while we work to desperately wrangle it back to our imageless monologue. We are working, I think, against the way that God has designed our minds rather than with it, and we are frustrating our attempt to pray in the process. We are despairing our arduous and ultimately shallow efforts to simply talk with God, and prayer itself becomes cumbersome and tedious and not all that desirable. This is your life. It's ending one moment at a time. Now, imaginative prayer is really about appreciating and stewarding the brain's remarkable resource of imagination in our shared life with God. When you begin, this is going to take, you guessed it, practice. Especially for those of you to whom this concept is entirely new. Even for those seasoned in utilizing the imagination, I would argue that the focused and disciplined practices of imaginative prayer can further unlock the incredible potential of what you already know to be quite good. So in just a moment, I'm going to lead you through a particular imaginative practice sometimes called resting in Jesus. And this practice is simply quality time for quality time's sake. So, it works best when it is scheduled. When I was beginning, I set an actual calendar appointment every Friday at the same time and same place, and I honored it the same way I would honor other meeting to which I had committed. If you struggle with flakiness, personally, that's a whole other teaching, and I don't want to make everyone hate me with what could easily become a ferocious rant. So I'll just stop there. Gerald can give you the ferocious rant on flakiness later. Or I suppose John Mark is better suited for that. You know, they have that whole good cop, bad cop thing going on. Really, if we're being entirely honest, the ferocious rant thing is probably best for Bethany. So wait on that from her. The point is, you will want more of a plan than simply, oh, maybe at the end of my morning routine or sometimes this week I might try it. Schedule a time like it is an actual meeting with Jesus and stick to it. And then it begins with a setting. The actual physical space in which you sit and pray is important. And though it is crucial, the nuance and specifics will vary from person to person. You'd know this already if you've done the practices up to this point. You may need to experiment to discover what best sets the scene for your particular approach to the practice. Now, barring the unique specifics, you'll certainly want a place where you can be alone, that's comfortable, quiet, sure to be free of interruption and distraction. You probably know that by default. Personally, I prefer a space that's free of clutter, that's dimly lit. Maybe you want to light a candle if candles are your thing, though I doubt many of us would like to be known as the person for whom candles are our thing, you know? There's some obvious overlap with this particular practice and other disciplines, but it's important to point this out. This practice is not silence and solitude. So I find it tremendously helpful to provide a soundtrack to the time. I use a playlist of my own design. It's populated by instrumental pieces and ambient scores and, atmospheric piano suites, whatever, that sort of thing. You certainly don't want anything with lyrics or vocals, words that will distract you from what you're trying to pray. Some of you may prefer no music at all, which is totally fine. And the idea is not to trick your emotions and to contrive an experience with the setting, but the idea is to recognize that we are affected by our physical environment and to thus create a space that will stimulate our imagination rather than stifling it. Does that difference make sense? Yes? Okay. To some of you, it does. Once you've arrived at your scheduled time and prepared the proper setting, you'll make yourself comfortable enough so that you can relax, not so comfortable that you'll fall asleep. Find that tension. And then you begin by inviting the Holy Spirit to steer your imagination, so to speak. You ask quite plainly, and this is okay, for an experience of God. That is what you're after. Ask the Spirit that you might meet with God through the vehicle of your imagination. And next, you will engage your imagination in order to prepare something called the inner sanctuary. This will be an environment uniquely yours. When you're just beginning, you'll want to imagine a place that's deeply familiar and associated with nothing but fond memories, some place that is both serene and that you are able to recall in vivid detail. It's important that this place is safe and comfortable and set apart from the otherwise chaotic nature of life. You know, you may love some patio outside of your favorite coffee house, but it isn't exactly quietly set apart or serene, so that's important. One place I've often used as an example is a clearing in a forest where behind the home where I grew up as a kid in Georgia. So there's this old oak tree from which Spanish moss hangs from its low, sprawling branches. And in the fall, the sky is this even gray, and there's this cool breeze that moves gently through the trees and the surrounding woods. There's this low drone of birds and insects. All else is silent. And as a child, as an adolescent, and even a few times as an adult, I would sit beneath this tree and I would pray. And I can recreate that scene with some ease in my mind. I can imagine the smells and the sounds and the feel of the wind on my skin. I can represent the scene the way I liked it best, which is overcast and cool, either morning or at dusk. So I take my time in recreating the scene in my mind, picturing it as clearly as I possibly can. Next, you'll imagine yourself entering into your inner sanctuary. I know the walk to this clearing in the forest very well, so I like to imagine myself venturing out into it as a means of sort of setting the stage and getting my focus. When I arrive at my inner sanctuary, I imagine myself approaching the tree, sitting beneath it, and taking the scene in. And I wait there, and I calm my breathing, and I relax, and I feel the wind, and I smell the air. I listen to the ambience of the wood. And then, when I am peacefully focused, I look up and I imagine Jesus in the distance walking through the grass to come and sit with me. Jesus is always smiling because despite my frustrating habit to believe otherwise, he's somehow so happy to come and sit with me. Sometimes I run to Jesus in my imagination, embrace him as he approaches. Other times I smile back and I wait for him to come and sit. And here begins the primary function of the practice in question, to encounter Jesus, to allow God's Spirit to make the realness of Jesus as concrete and as experiential as possible by enabling us to imagine him as vividly as possible. And the point is not simply to picture Jesus and then think your own thoughts about him, as it were, but to actually encounter God himself through your Spirit-led imagination. Richard Foster wrote about this practice and put it this way: you can actually encounter the living Christ, be addressed by his voice, touched by his healing power. It can be more than an exercise of the imagination. It can be a genuine confrontation. Jesus Christ will actually come to you. Here we are opening our imaginations, the primary means by which we are relationally shaped, to God's Spirit, so that we can meet with, speak to, and hear from Jesus there. And when we've opened our imaginations to the Spirit, it's the Spirit who does the heavy lifting. We don't have to contrive an experience or do all the work ourselves. So when you've set the scene, when you've imagined Jesus meeting you there, then what? Well, a brief word on what is and is not important in this exercise. First, we do not know the exact details of Jesus' physical appearance and thus shouldn't worry ourselves terribly about imagining him with perfect accuracy physically. Given the fact that Jesus did not sit for an oil painting that I know of or fashion some self-representing mosaic on a floor somewhere that we found, you simply do the best you can. Of course, many, if not all of us, already have some immediate image that comes to mind when you think Jesus. And maybe that image could be just fine. Others may prefer something else, not for the sake of accuracy, because we don't have it, but to accommodate what you can imagine well. Honestly, when I first began, I found a picture of Jesus that I found helpful. I printed it out. I kept it with me as a visual anchor. So if I felt the image begin to slip, I would just look at it. Oh yeah, he looks like this in my imagination. That's helpful. In any event, it really isn't the accuracy of Jesus' physical attributes that will inform this practice. It is the accuracy of his character. Greg Boyd wrote this excellent book on this practice called Seeing is Believing. It's for sale out there, and it's also on practicingtheway.org if you'd like to read it. And in it, he writes this: the color of Jesus' eyes doesn't matter, but the love, care, and compassion shown through them does. The length of Jesus' beard, or for that matter, whether he has a beard, is of no consequence, but the tenderness of his smile and the loving words that come forth from his lips are of infinite consequence. The height and build of Jesus' body matters nothing, but the love expressed in his hug and the compassion of his caressing hand matter everything. So with the scene set, and both you and Jesus in it, what follows will become led by the Spirit the more that you practice. In the beginning, I realize you'll want something to go off of, so I would suggest something that proved massively beneficial for me as I waded further into the shallow end of this practice slowly over time. Having been joined by Jesus in my inner sanctuary, I would then imagine Jesus speaking over me certain things I know to be true from the Scriptures. They're trustworthy, I didn't make them up, and I know that he thinks these things about me. So I wrote certain passages down, and in my mind, I would take my time, read them one by one, and I would imaginatively hear Jesus tell me that he loves me with an everlasting love, that he rejoices over me with singing and dancing, that I am holy and blameless, precious in the sight of God, the apple of God's eye, that I'm forgiven and free from condemnation, that Jesus will never leave or abandon me. I am God's dear child. I would take my time, and I would imagine Jesus in the scene in as much vivid detail as I could possibly muster, and I would allow him to speak over me as I look into his eyes. And because of the Scriptures, I already know that all these things are true of me, and they're trustworthy. I didn't make them up. But when I imagine Jesus in my mind, when I embrace him under that tree and he tells me these things, it has an incredible healing power that merely reading or thinking these facts as just strings of information simply does not have for me personally. And from there, the time can go any number of ways. Sometimes, after Jesus speaks over me, I simply talk back, pray. In my ordinary, imperfect words, I tell him that I love him, I thank him for this kindness and gentleness and his affection for me. Ordinarily, for me personally, Jesus will then take me somewhere else. He will sometimes bring me to some memory of mine, good or bad, and with he and I standing together, beholding the scene as though we were like Ebenezer Scrooge in The Ghost of Christmas Past, watching the same, he'll draw my attention to something and say, "Hey, look, Josh, I want you to see something that you missed earlier." And that guy's real sneaky, you know? You go into these things thinking this will just be fine ordinarily, get excited for the day, and then you get all weepy and everything and have to come out explaining why. Anyway, he's sneaky. Get ready for that. So just recently, he brought my memory to this. It was just that earlier that day, and he showed me this scene of my son and I outside playing in the grass with dinosaurs, and my son's 3. And he says, "Wow," Jesus is pointing to the scene and be like, "Look at this. I want you to see this." I'm like, "I did see it. I was there." And he's like, "I know, but I want you to see. Look, what a good dad you are. Do you see how you love him, how you delight in him without reservation? You're completely uninformed by his behavior or anything that he has or hasn't done for you." And I say, "Yes, I do see that. Thank you, Jesus, for noticing that." But then, Jesus will say, oh, how your Father in heaven loves you so much more. And then I say, ah, dang it. Sometimes Jesus will walk with me into some display of the world's brokenness, some tragic scene, and together we'll see hurting people or war, or something I just read on the news, fractured families, systemic violence, racism, all this stuff. But then Jesus will give me an incredible vision of what it will be like when he reverses those things, when he makes everything new, when he heals the entire world. And I will be driven to tears or to worship, and I will be have a new reawakened hunger to see God's kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. And as I mentioned earlier, this is really one exercise within the broad discipline of imaginative prayer. The more that I practiced personally and the more that I spent time with Jesus working to engage my imagination in all its vivid potential, it was a clumsy, slow process, but I began to realize the power of imagination in all of prayer. So when I pray healing or comfort or peace for someone, I actually imagine, visualize that Jesus is wherever that person is, that he steps into their home or their workplace and that he embraces them or he puts his healing hands on them. My mind is representing reality to me in this way, even though it is not physically happening. When I pray against evil, I realize this sounds funny, but sometimes I imagine like a horde of devious dark creatures that are fleeing at the mere mention of the name of Jesus. And I realize that demons are not physical, but my imagination represents to me the reality of my prayer's powerful authority over the demonic realm. When I present my request to God, I imagine myself stepping into this garden-like city. It looks a lot like Naboo from Star Wars prequels for some reason, which can't be from the Spirit, you know, but there it is. That's just me. Spirit's working with me in my fallenness. John Mark, if you're listening to this podcast, that was for you. Anyway, so I step into this city, and Jesus is there on his throne. He's surrounded by his heavenly council, and I kneel before Jesus' throne, and he holds up a hand calling for silence, and he says, hey, everyone, hang on. Josh, my friend, my beloved, has something he wants to ask me about. And my imagination is really just representing to me the truth of the Scriptures. I am invited to boldly approach the throne of grace. Even though this isn't physically happening, it is a reality nonetheless. With the guidance of other people, imaginative prayer can be used to revisit painful memories or lies that we've been led to believe about ourselves or about God, so that God's Spirit can speak over and heal past trauma and narrative scripts that we've inherited. This is a practice often called healing memories or inner healing prayer, and it is a discipline within the rubric of imaginative prayer. Now, when I see all of this in my imagination again and again, I begin to find myself shaped by memories, by visuals and experiences that I can recall, conversations that I've had with Jesus. I remember the things he said. I remember where we were when he said them, what I felt and what I saw and what I heard. And soon I found that my imagination began to engage with minimal or no effort. In the beginning, it was quite a belabored effort, and then it became less and less so. I would find myself face to face with Jesus in my imagination suddenly throughout the day, where he would speak or offer unsolicited comfort or kindness or guidance. I remember once in this room, in the midst of worship here at Bridgetown, suddenly seeing Jesus as we all worshiped, and he was smiling and dancing in celebration. It was a beautiful, beautiful moment. And this week's practice is about learning what it means to pray using your imagination. When you get together with your community, you'll go to practicingtheway.org and begin to schedule time to meet with Jesus. In the years that I've entertained conversations about imaginative prayer with a variety of folks, I've seen so many who were enthused, very little convincing needed to be done, and others who were skeptical and reticent, understandably so. Wherever this finds you, my humble and gentle plea is twofold. One, give it a try. No one dies. You'll be fine. Just try it. And then two, don't give up. It does take time and it does take practice. Perhaps some of you will feel a bit awkward to begin with. That's okay. Many disciplines, I'm sure you know if you've done any of the practice, many new disciplines are awkward the first time around, and that doesn't mean that we abandon them. Many can't seem to fight off the nagging notion that this is all in your head. And really, that is partly true. It is in your head, so to speak, but that does not make it untrue. Maybe stuff comes to mind, but you'll feel as though you're simply thinking and nothing else is actually taking place. And that's understandable. The Spirit does not put us into a trance and completely commandeer our minds when He speaks. If that's what you're waiting on, don't hold your breath. You'll never believe God is speaking to you. Instead, humbly entertain the possibility that what happens in your imagination could be from God. Test it and try it again. I realize that since I've gone on about this for, you know, some 40 minutes now, maybe some of you are thinking, well, that's all well and good for him. He must be wired for that sort of thing. I don't think in it, whatever it might be. And I would really just encourage you guys to not write it off because of me or whatever you might have be assuming. I am not any kind of prayer wizard. This is not something that came easily to me. It was something that I stumbled into quite clumsily. And that took a lot of time for me to get, but really, personally for me, and this is not an exaggeration, I'm not trying to sell you a thing, this was, for me, the thing that unlocked a new radical level of intimacy with Jesus, and the thing that personally, for me, frankly, made me want to pray after years and years and years of following Jesus. So if the Holy Spirit can speak to us by direct deposit into our minds, as many of you believe full well, He can certainly guide and inform our imagination as we work to engage it in prayer. This week, my prayer for you and for me is that we would begin down a formational road, that you would hear and see and touch Jesus, that you would know His kindness and His a deep, deep affection for you, in both the Scriptures and in the way that He looks at you with His loving smile and His gentle touch, that you would see the kindness in His eyes. May we meet with Jesus this week.